Hello and welcome back to the second part of this interview with Dr. David Penny on insects. Now we've got the competition results to announce. We had 108 people like our post on Facebook. We took all of those, used the random number generator, and the winner of the book Fossil Insects, written by Dr. David Penny, published by Dr. David Penny, and signed by Dr. David Penny, is, of course, Dr. David Penny. And now I'm honestly not making it up. There was a 1 in 108 chance of this. And it just leaves us with the question, why did Dave enter the competition to win his own book? Anyway, I've taken the liberty to graciously decline the award on Dave's behalf. I think that you may have a copy of this somewhere already. And so we've redrawn the results and the new winner is David Brissan. So congratulations and we'll be in touch soon. Additionally, we've had some really great news here at PaleoCast. We're finalists in this year's Podcast Awards. We're amongst 10 shows up for the Best Education Podcast, and we're really, really humbled. Speaking personally, this is something that I started in my bedroom 2.5 years ago, and to become a top 10 educational podcast, as voted for by you, the public, is more than I ever could have dreamed for. Public voting is now open for the overall winner, so please go to podcastawards.com and vote for us in the education category. You can vote every day if you so choose, but a top 10 finish is more than I ever could have asked for. So, a big thank you for everyone who voted us into the finals, and of course, all the recognition should go to the academics who've been interviewed, without whose time and knowledge there could be no show. So, speaking of a show, we now start the second half of this interview on insects with Dr. Dave Penny. By me, Dave Marshall. Dave Brissan won the competition. And don't forget to listen to any of our other interviews, such as with Dave Rudkin, Dave Hone, Dave Harper, or Dave Horn. I hope you have a good day. Okay, so in your book, you give an introduction to the insects, but you also highlight some of the localities and some of the Lagerstätte, the sites of special preservation, which insects are found in all around the world. So where are some of the standout places? Is there anywhere that's particularly good for finding insects?
Fossil insect deposits are probably much more numerous than most people realise. So, for example, from Spain alone, there are more than 40 different localities that yield fossil insects. So an exhaustive list would require a much thicker volume. In fact, it would probably go into several volumes. So really all I can do is pick out a few examples that for me are kind of standout deposits. And I'd have to say the Carboniferous. So to cover the geological spectrum, I'd say the Carboniferous swamp forests of Europe, the Permian deposits of Russia and Elmo, Kansas, the USA, the Jurassic of China. We've already mentioned the Cretaceous-Crato formation of Brazil, which is an incredibly diverse fossil insect fauna, and the Paleogene and Neogene amber deposits of the Baltic region and the Dominican Republic, respectively. Non-amber tertiary deposits, we're talking the Florissant formation of Colorado, which is famed for its butterfly fossils.
Oh,
and the Messel oil shales of Germany, which is famed for colour preservation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's just a handful, but there are many, many more.
So a lot of Lagerstätte and a lot of fossil deposits in general have an association with water. And what I was wondering was if we have a biased representation of insects that have some kind of an aquatic stage in their life. So you'll have things like, say, scarab beetles in the desert that don't really have much of a chance of being preserved. But if you have, say, mosquitoes, which have an aquatic larvae and therefore a link to the water, is it more likely that we get these aquatic insects preserved?
Not necessarily. Of course, aquatic insects are preserved, but so too are non-aquatic forms. In some cases, these terrestrial species that are preserved represent organisms that didn't actually live near the water body. In some cases, the dead insects were transported over long distances. And there are clues in the taphonomy. So if you find lots of disarticulated remains, for example, isolated beetle wing cases, that's kind of evidence that the organism has been transported over a long distance and has broken up during that process of transport.
So the taphonomy is everything that's happened to an organism after it's died, yeah, and as it gets preserved.
Yes, yeah. From the point of death until the point at which it becomes a fossil.
Okay.
And so on the other flip side of that is the more articulated, the more complete the fossil is, the chances are it lived closer to the depositional setting, i.e. to the water body, and died close by. And we kind of know this, as Dina Smith did a study very recently, or within the last few years or the last decade, whereby she looked at beetles that lived around a lake and then looked at the elytra that were preserved in the sediment of the lake. And intuitively, you would expect they'd be quite similar. But in fact, they weren't. They were quite different. So the things that were living near the lake were not actually getting into the sediment in a manner that they would then be preserved as fossils. So the stuff that was there has been carried in from further afield. So great care needs to be taken when trying to interpret these fossil assemblages because of factors such as this.
So how are insects generally fossilized?
Normally they are preserved in amber, so resin, well, they're caught in resin that then subsequently hardens and forms amber. That's probably the best preservation. But you also get excellent preservation in some rocks as well. And it tends to be the finer grained the sediment, the better the preservation in the rock. But wherever you find, you know, insects are small. Most of them tend to be rather small. And they have soft bodies, so they've not got shells and they haven't got bones like, you know, dinosaurs and mollusks. So anyway, you do get fossil insect preservation, we tend to classify it as a lagerstätte.
So one of the methods of preservation that you mentioned there was amber. How important is amber for paleoentomology? Like, what kind of unique insights does it offer? We spoke to George Poynar in episode 3, I think, about the intricate nature that the impressive paleoecological information that you could get out. We had insects with parasites bursting out of them. So how important has amber been for our understanding?
Amber is incredibly important for understanding of paleoentomology, particularly from the Cretaceous onwards. Before the Cretaceous, the only amber inclusions that we have are just a couple of arthropods in Triassic amber from Italy, but there's no arthropods in amber from the Jurassic. So from the Cretaceous onwards, amber is particularly important because of, for various reasons, there's the exceptional preservation that we see in the amber, but also the sheer number and diversity of inclusions. And when I say sheer number, I mean we're talking millions of specimens. We are talking millions of fossils. And so what that means is there is great, great potential that far exceeds most non-amber settings for quantitative investigations and paleoecological investigations. But unfortunately, very little paleoentomological research is focused on this at present. And I'm hoping this will change because I think that people are missing a great opportunity here. From a more qualitative perspective, are examples of what we call disjunct distributions. What that is we have many higher taxa in Baltic amber, such as beetle genera or families of insects, that today no longer exist in that region. So their closest relatives may be in North America, in Southeast Asia, or in South Africa. So they've shifted their distribution significantly over time. Now, obviously, we're going on about climate change at the moment and what's going to happen as a result. Surely, if we look at these fossils, they can maybe provide us with some clues as to who the winners and who the losers may be with regard to climate change and its effect on the insect faunas of the world.
So regarding the Jurassic blackout of amber inclusions, is that really intricately linked to what kind of vegetation there was there?
I don't think so. I don't know. It's a difficult one, that, because we have loads of Cretaceous amber from Lebanon. And that's really the oldest amber ecosystem that has a diverse arthropod fauna preserved in it. Now, we've got Jurassic amber from Lebanon as well. And that's where we're not seeing anything. Why that is, I'm...
So you're getting the amber but not the insects?
Yes.
I thought
yes.
That you were not getting the amber.
No, we're getting the amber. There's just nothing in it, as yet.
Weird.
Clearly, if we're finding the Triassic amber with stuff in, we should be finding stuff in the Jurassic as well. And maybe we will. I expect we will do at some point.
That's really confused me now, yeah. Well, I enjoy working that one out. So what's the actual proportion of amber to have inclusions in it?
Oh, that's a difficult one. It varies depending on the deposit. So I'm kind of at a loss to give you any reliable numbers there. But it may be 1 in 100 pieces for Baltic amber.
Okay.
Possibly, but don't quote me on that.
So in the book, you also cover a lot of the insect groups. Is this also exhaustive? Have you covered every single insect fossil?
Well, we've not covered every fossil because there are a lot. And there's probably 25,000 different species described so far. Compare that with dinosaurs, where there's probably 1,500, and yet they take all the glory. What's all that about?
I don't know. I've been trying to work this out for about 3 years that I've been doing this podcast.
Yeah. So we couldn't cover every fossil, but what we've done is we've included every single insect order. So it is exhaustive in that respect. So all the fossil orders and all the extant living orders are included.
So orders in the taxonomic ranking...
Yeah.
Got species, genus, family...
Order. Yeah.
So it's pretty high up.
Yeah.
What order are we?
We're primates.
Primates?
Yeah.
Okay. So at that level...
So Lepidoptera, butterflies and moths, Diptera, flies, Hymenoptera, ants, bees and wasps, Coleoptera, beetles, that kind of thing, Raphidioptera, snake flies. That's the level.
That's at the ordinal level?
Yeah.
Right, okay. So it's still pretty high...
Yeah. But it covers all groups, really.
Okay, so what are some of the longest ranging groups? Which are the first we see? I think you said springtails?
Yeah, I mean, that's where we get the first insect-like organisms in the Devonian. But the groups that we commonly see today, such as beetles and wasps, they are probably some of the longest of the extant orders, and they appear first in the Permian.
Okay. And so were the ones that we had in the Devonian, Carboniferous, very different to what we have now?
Certainly some of the Permian and Carboniferous insects were very different from what's around today. But there are also extinct families from extant orders that were quite different as well. So one of my favourites is a family called Calligrammatidae. And that's a family of Neuroptera. and they have large wings that usually have eye spots. And they're often referred to as butterflies of the Jurassic, say from the Jurassic period. But they're not butterflies. They are neuropterans, lace wings.
Okay, so that's...
But if you see a fossil with the wings spread out, you can see it looks like a butterfly. It really resembles a butterfly.
So to the layman, is that kind of like a fly type thing?
It's, no. You've probably seen them. You get them in the UK. They tend to be green and they have very fine, delicate lace-like wings. And they're about an inch long or 2.5 centimetres.
And were they pretty big in the Jurassic or about the same size?
I expect some were probably larger.
So are there any extinct groups that are radically different to what we know today?
Some of the orders were different. And when you say radically, I mean, not really, because all insects have the same kind of body plan. But you could certainly look at something and say, well, yeah, that doesn't fit into any of the classification of insects that we have today. So that was something different. But in other instances, it might just be elements of the wing venation that differ.
So what have these fossils been able to tell us about the paleoecology of some of these groups?
There's an idea called behavioural fixity, and that states that organisms in the past are likely to have behaved in the same way that their modern living counterparts do today. So basically what that means is that the organisms that are around today give us clues as to how the fossil organisms probably behaved in the past. But clearly that's only going to work if the fossils have close living relatives. So in a case where we're dealing with extinct orders and we don't have a modern living counterpart, then it becomes much more difficult to try and infer a mode of life or the ecology and behaviour of the fossils concerned. Nonetheless, we can still get kind of clues from various elements of the morphology, such as wing banding and eye spots and patterning, may be evidence of crypsis or warning behavioural strategies. Mouth parts can give a clue as to what the organism may have fed on. Relative wing size can give us clues as to how whether they were strong flyers, fast flyers, weak flyers, and internal and external genitalia and egg-laying apparatuses such as ovipositors can give us clues into how the organisms reproduced.
Is there anything that we look at and just say, I have no idea what that was doing? Why does it have such giant legs at the front?
Well, that's true of today. You know, there are many, many features of insects that we just go, wow, what's that all about? You know, what's that for? And why does it need that? And how does it do this? And so the fossil record is even more difficult to interpret. So, yeah.
I guess it's a case of getting the modern nailed down before you infer things from the past.
Not necessarily, because I'd say that would detract from the reasons for studying fossil insects. I think we need to do both concurrently.
Okay, and what can insects teach us about past environments?
The fossils, well, as I've kind of just indicated, the behavioural fixity issue, whereby things in the past would have behaved the same way they do today. So if you take a look at insects today, many of the higher taxa, such as families and orders, have quite specific climatic and environmental tolerances. So we can use that knowledge to reconstruct fossil ecosystems. And we can do that based on single taxa, which may be classed as indicator taxa, or we can do it on a broader scale using the relative abundance of different insect groups in the particular assemblages, which can also provide us with clues. But again, you know, there are always exceptions to the rule, so we have to be careful. And one example of that is the order Ophidioptera, which are snake flies. Now, today, Raphidiopterans, or snake flies, are only found in temperate climates. But in the past, we know they were much more diverse and they were found in warmer climates. Another example of that might be the abundance of aquatic taxa. I know you mentioned aquatic taxa earlier on. So if you look at Baltic amber, for example, and Dominican amber, you might think they're going to sample kind of similar things. The abundance of, or the frequency of aquatic taxa in Baltic amber is around 25%. You know, 25% of inclusions are of aquatic organisms. Whereas in Dominican amber, that value is much, much lower. And this can provide clues as to the availability of freshwater habitats within those fossil ecosystems. So we know there was a lot of freshwater in the Baltic amber forest, much more so compared to that in the Dominican amber forest.
I just want to make sure that when you say aquatic taxa, that's one with an aquatic stage in its life cycle. You don't actually get the aquatic stage in the amber.
Sometimes you do.
What?
Yeah.
How?
Diving beetle larvae. You know, you get all sorts of things, and you get these really, really unusual occurrences of things that were in the water. Now, how it happens, we're not exactly sure, and they're not that common, but it does happen. You know, whether these things have kind of crawled out of the water a little bit and then a dollop of resin had fallen on them, or whether there was a log that had fallen under. We don't exactly know how resin samples things, but we do get these unusual occurrences of aquatic organisms. But yes, you're quite right. On the whole, when I'm talking about aquatic organisms in Baltic amber or various ambers, I'm talking about the adult stages whereby we know that the larvae were aquatic. But yeah, we do get these rare instances. Another and possibly more pertinent question, rather than, you know, what can they tell us about the past, we could ask, what can they tell us about the future? You know, and many people don't look at fossils and say, well, what can these fossils tell us about the future? They think, what can fossils tell us about the past? But I'm interested in what they can tell us about the future. So if you think about the present is clearly a function of the past. Yeah. And likewise, the future is the function of the present and the past combined. And as mentioned earlier, our current insect biodiversity is but a mere snapshot of that which has existed on Earth for approximately 400 million years. Hence, the value of fossils in addressing, you know, what may be happening as a result of climate change, clearly, and the disjunct distributions that I mentioned earlier, clearly that can help us shed some light, possibly, on who may be the winners and who may be the losers in the future as a result of what's going on at the moment. And if we ignore fossils, we're actually excluding a huge amount of potentially useful data in our analyses.
I guess that really shows the importance of them.
But yeah, they're not just cool, they're really important.
Well, that was my other point. What recommendations would you give any aspiring paleoentomologist? Learn how to pronounce the word first. That's
yeah,
the first
that's
bit of
a
advice.
Good one. Well, at least spell it. I'd say do it. You know, it's great fun and it's very rewarding. And the combination of very few people actually studying fossil insects and the superabundance of fossil insects means that there's so much to discover relatively easily. In addition to sort of basic taxonomy and systematics, you know, working out how things are related to one another, the sheer abundance of fossil insects and the disjunct distributions means that we can address the important broader biological issues that are of concern today. And we can do this quantitatively using statistical techniques, or we can do it more qualitatively. You know, we've got the data there to do it if we put it all together and we use it. But, you know, there's a rather complex skill set that's required to study and interpret fossil insects effectively. And again, this comes back to the idea that we're merging two massive disciplines, paleontology and entomology. And most students are not, they're learning one or the other, and they're not getting the overlap. And that's kind of where this book is coming into play, to try and bridge that gap. So it's important to try and get a good grasp of both these disciplines prior to embarking on complicated projects. And because of the idea of disjunct distributions, whereby the fossils may not live in the region that they're found today, regional keys to insect faunas of those regions are not necessarily useful for identifying the fossils. So you need to have a global knowledge of insect diversity and taxonomy, and preferably you need to have access to a global collection of modern insect material for comparative purposes, so that you can kind of identify your fossils. And along with that goes access to the often difficult to obtain literature for identifying not just fossil insects, but modern insects as well. So there's lots of obstacles to overcome. And in that last regard, museum entomological collections are usually a good place to start. If you can find a friendly curator and get access to the collections, you can learn a great deal and have access to a remarkable resource. You know, there are other issues as well, and there is actually a chapter at the end of the book which addresses these, you know, what you need to do in terms of actually getting into the field and what you really need to know, what will help you on the way to become a paleoentomologist. And, you know, it's my hope that the book encourages some people to do that.
So where could you get hold of this book? Is it on Amazon?
It's on Amazon. It's you can get it from online from various sources, but it's much better for me if you get it from my website. Purely because it helps us produce more books, basically.
Okay, well, Dave, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programs. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.